Hello and welcome to Palm Drive Capital's Innovators Are Everywhere podcast, where we talk to founders and investors to hear about the problems they are solving, the challenges they have overcome, and the lessons they have learned along the way. Now kick up your feet and have a listen.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Palm Drive's podcast. And today we have Sarah Chen, co-founder of Beyond Billion with us. Hey Sarah, welcome. Tell us about your background and Beyond Billion.
Hey Catherine, thanks so much for having me. Really a pleasure to be partnering with Palm Drive again. A little bit about me, I'm Malaysian born. I graduated with a law degree, but you know, realized by year two after some high-flying internships, including one that placed me in a suite overlooking Chicago's Millennium Park, that you know, being a lawyer while respectable, and I fully, you know, hat tip to everyone who's doing that right now, but it was not going to be a career that would get me out of a bed. And frankly, I was more interested, you know, during the internship, I was more interested in the business discussions with the entrepreneurs who were our clients at that time, rather than the, you know, M&A and the paperwork behind the scenes that we were facilitating. So, you know, that really, I think, drove me to think differently when I graduated. Unfortunately, my father was unwell, and I did a bit of a stint with my family business during a time that, you know, my father was frankly dying, and I knew this was about to happen. And at about 21 years old, I had to step in as his voice in an interim. And that really taught me a lot about business. It was really hard, but, you know, really showed me the power of business and what you can do, and really inspired my path later on. And as you can imagine, being a 21, 22 year old running a business with staff that were older than me, better than me in so many ways, I was very stressed. And, you know, it was my late father's advice to perhaps, you know, get into the corporate world, gain a little bit more experience, which I did. And that was how I ended up as one of the first few hires, actually, of a spin-off corporate venture capital unit within a $14 billion Asian public listed company. And we had about $100 to $150 million to invest at that time into late-stage biotech companies. And that was really how I fell into venture and really loved it for, you know, the same reason that I was inspired by the entrepreneurs, right? How founders were building on their great ideas that have tremendous potential to change our world, the way we live, the way we work, and just the way we operate as a humanity. And sadly, along the way, you know, this was in Malaysia, of course, Muslim majority in Malaysia. I looked around me as a young 20-something in finance and venture, you know, guns blazing and looking for role models, and really didn't see women around me who spoke like me, thought like me. And in fact, as I'm sure you've been through, Catherine, you know, the finance world is very male dominated, and there are certain implications there for women, right? And that inspired me really to start a nonprofit alongside my corporate career. This is called Lean In Malaysia, which still exists today. In fact, we're 7,000 people strong now, but the idea behind that nonprofit that I was juggling with my corporate career was to get more women into leadership. At that time, I realized, you know, as I was looking for role models, the fact that there weren't many was because, you know, at a national level, only 5% of businesses of the top listed companies in Malaysia had women as CEOs. So I wanted to really do something, you know, a bit of a naive 20-something year old. And together with, you know, some friends, we decided, hey, let's create this platform. Let's talk about the issues here and let's try to do something about it. And you know, what came out of it was really multiple things, including now a strong career accelerator program to get women into leadership, so on and so forth. But the long and the short of it is that's how I became, I like to call it an accidental feminist. Of course, I was a feminist, I think from day one, you know, believing that women should be equal, you know, societally, politically, economically, but really that activated me into action, created, I guess, my brand with women in leadership. And along the way, life happened. I moved to the United States, Washington, D.C. specifically, and really had to figure out what next. I knew from a professional perspective that venture was what I wanted to continue. But, you know, in D.C., this wasn't exactly Silicon Valley or New York. So I networked like crazy. And the the end of it was I met my co-founder, Shelley Porges, at a time who really had the idea of the $1 billion fund for women. And when she told me about her idea, of course, because of her background as well, you know, in politics and in corporate as an investor, as an entrepreneur, two key things really spoke out to me during our conversation, which is, you know, women in leadership and venture capital, two things I really cared about. And at that time, you know, I was still searching, as I said, you know, for what next. And I frankly put up my hand and volunteered and said, hey, Shelley, let me help you. I think I can help you with this idea and grow it to a certain level. And we had an opportunity to present at the World Bank meetings in Bali in 2018. So 2018 was when I moved to the States and also was trying to build up my ground for what next. And it was really a serendipity that we came together. And the big idea of the $1 billion fund for women was to address the gender venture funding gap, where women founders were only receiving, and still today unfortunately receive, something like 2.2% of venture capital. And this campaign was really a capital campaign that inspired VCs to pledge to invest more into women-founded companies. And that's how we got started and off to the races.
Wow, that's really impressive. Yeah, we know that you've managed to convince GPs, LPs, and private investors to pledge a total of $1 billion USD to be invested into female-founded startups. Of course, PalmDrive also committed. And so what was the feedback like when first started versus now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Catherine. You know, when we started, frankly, I mean, you know, you now know, and the audience now knows the personal background to it. I had no idea. I had no idea what to expect, right? I mean, I was in the business of venture. I was doing the investing, but from a landscape perspective, this was the first time that I was making such an ask, right? To ask my friends who, sure, were in decision-making positions at that time, and that helped a lot, but would they actually do something like this? And it involved, you know, some really hard conversations with some people, bringing this idea up all the way to the investment committee to, of course, that get this approval. And of course, while the pledges were not actually legally binding, there were implications, right? And therefore, I think for many GPs, it was important for them. This, and a quick note on this as well, you know, like PalmDrive, we were approaching funds that were emerging and established that didn't necessarily have a specific gender lens. You know, they were investing in ag tech, fintech, SaaS, B2B, whatever, right? But the ask was, from, you know, your fund that you have, say 100 million, what can you commit to be invested into women founded companies within a certain period of time, right? And that period of time was 2018 to 2020, which was the campaign period. And, you know, there were some reluctance from some people just because it was, I think, the first of its kind. The landscape has changed now where there are a lot more pledge campaigns. But yeah, we had some hard conversations. We had some no's, some rejections, and I can share some of that as well. But by and large, I have to say I was pleasantly surprised by the energy and just the willingness of people to, especially the decision makers, to say, this is something I believe in. What do I have to do to actually make this pledge, right? And that was really the start of the conversation and really what inspired us to do this, right? And along the way, we learned that, hey, making this pledge is not just a pledge. To actually deploy it requires, you know, conscientious effort. And some of our GPs went so far as to, before making the pledge, actually examine how are they making these decisions, right? What does the funnel, what does the deal flow actually look like? Are we 50-50 and are the numbers dwindling down towards the end as we evaluate them? Or do we not even have enough of a robust pipeline of female founders coming through? And what do we have to do to change that? And, you know, I think in terms of expectations, because I started with no expectations and, you know, some element of naivety, I was pleasantly surprised, encouraged. And the fact that we got to $1 billion in under 9 months, Catherine, that just lit a fire in us that, hey, this is real. This is the time we have to make the most of this platform. And I'm happy to share, you know, the question was, what's the current status? In under 9 months, we had over 86 funds with, you know, assets under management of more than $12 billion, pledging just over $1 billion to be deployed by December 31st, 2020, right? And and last year, we had the opportunity to hold our funds accountable. That was always very important to us to see, you know, whether they were putting money where their mouth was, and including Palm Drive, right, who reported really positive results. As a whole consortium, over 61% of this capital had already been deployed in 2 years. So that's about 638 million into 795 companies with female founders. And of these, you know, companies, we had a subset, because we work with PitchBook to help us with the data, a subset of 479 of the deals actually went on to raise more than $4 billion within the timeframe of the pledge campaign, i.e. 2018 to 2020. So, you know, I think after 3 years of engaging with the global community of LPs, the VCs and the founders, and with these results, you know, we've made some progress. I'm clearly an optimist to be doing the work that I'm doing, but clearly we've not made enough progress. You know, the absolute numbers have improved, but women are still getting a smaller size slice of the pie. And we can even talk about this, but the fact that COVID happened and women were disproportionately affected, it was almost, we took one step forward and two steps back. And, you know, it's important that we think about the gender imbalance at all levels, right? And one of the key things in our initiative was always to look at the entire supply chain of capital. So not necessarily just the female founders to the VC. I think that's what people think, you know, when solving this problem, oh, the VCs are not giving the money. But the reality is, what we found out through our campaign, the Billion Dollar Fund for Women, and really beyond the billion, is that, you know, it starts with the allocators and the asset owners that actually fund the VC firms, which then fund the beneficiaries, which are the female founders. So, you know, a couple of, you know, worrying trends that we're seeing, but as a whole, I think we're moving in the right direction. And I'm hopeful, especially with the pandemic, the fact that we've seen the costs on women, not just female founders, but women, right? Women dropping out from the workforce, so on and so forth, that it is crucial for us not to revert to patterns of the past, right? So, and I'm sure you've seen this, Catherine, even with Palm Drive during the time of a crisis, you know, March 2020, when we first found out about COVID, the number one thing that funds were thinking about was how can we salvage our portfolio? How can we make sure they survive? And that actually meant that, you know, remember, again, 88% of all venture funding today still goes to all male teams. And that meant that the capital was focused on those all male teams, and women were getting less and less. So there are a lot of, you know, nuances here that we have to think about. But I think, you know, what we've shown with just the Billion Dollar Fund for Women, and what inspired us to go beyond the billion, is the fact that determined investors with a bias to action together can create something wonderful. And we can solve this problem in our lifetime, but it takes concerted effort and commitment, and really working with the entire supply chain of capital. It's not just the responsibility of founders to ask for more or to, you know, quote unquote, break the bias as female founders, but it's also for VCs to, you know, really rethink and re-engineer, and as well the LPs. And together, I'm hopeful that, you know, what we started will only continue in the right trajectory.
Well, that's really great to see the big progress, and I'm so proud that Palm Drive is part of this. Yeah, we know, like, from the macro environment perspective, I think since the 2018 inauguration of Beyond the Billion, ESG is getting more and more important to not only GPs, but also LPs. Do you see a shift happening in the financial industry already, or you think it's too early to tell?
You know, first of all, I think ESG has become increasingly mainstream for investors in recent years, right? And it's part of a broader wave of purpose and aligning profit and purpose and stakeholder capitalism. And today, I think something like 100 trillion in assets under management are managed globally according to ESG, right? And a lot of that is actually pushed by the business case of ESG, the fact that we've actually seen some funds with high ESG performance actually outperform their peers financially, right? So I think, especially even with COVID, over the last sort of, let me think, 18 months, things have changed with, you know, people really being concerned about the ethics of businesses. And I think, you know, COVID has really put a magnifying lens on what's important and how our monies and investments can actually create sustainable results, right? Having said that, though, I see venture capital to be largely left by the wayside. You know, sure, we're seeing a lot more funds actually use ESG in their materials, but whether they're doing it in a way that is comprehensive, yet to be seen. In fact, I was just looking up before a call, a Stanford study actually did a quick scan of even just the websites of the top 50 largest VC funds and only found 5 that mentioned ESG or even a commitment to sustainability. But of course, you know, within our portfolio, I have to say our portfolio of funds, including people like PalmDrive, a lot of our funds, because they're already starting to, you know, with us, they're thinking about diversity, right? And remember, diversity, I like to think of investing in women as very much ingrained into the ESG framework, whether that's social, whether that's governance. We're actually seeing women, women founders and actually funders being very impact first. And that has also climate implications to it, right? So thinking about the environment in their investments and the impact there. I like to think that from an anecdotal perspective, so we haven't done the full review and we should, that's something that's on our docket. But a lot of our partner funds that are already investing in women that say, you know, we have the welcome mat open for you, actually are thinking about ESG and actually building that into the way they invest. So if LPs are tuning in, right, I think this, the fact that they've pledged to the $1 billion fund for women is step one in actually identifying how funds are thinking ahead and upstream, right? I think that's really important. You're seeing big asset managers, you know, people like BlackRock, TPG Rise, Bain Capital, all of them have impact funds now, and they're actually incorporating ESG ratings, right? So what does that point to? That points to the fact that a lot of capital globally is already being focused on ESG. So this is going to be the wave, and I think it'll be only a matter of time that venture continues in this trajectory.
Yeah, totally agreed. And at PalmDrive, we've always cared about like social impact and gender diversity. I think we have about like 16% of our portfolio companies with female founders or co-founders. I think my question here is, what kind of metrics do you suggest to truly measure the female friendliness of a fund, like beyond the rate of gender diversity within the portfolio companies?
Yeah, that's a good question, Catherine. You know, female friendliness, I think, is a very broad term, right? And the way, of course, the way we started, and this was also, I mean, we created this pledge campaign with a lot of feedback from investors themselves on what they could do and what they could commit to and so on and so forth. And that was investing in companies that had either a female founder or a female co-founder, right? Where she has meaningful equity share within the company and that's demonstrating her influence. And we chose that as one of the key criterion because we've also seen cases where, you know, you need to pay attention to the cap table because we've seen where the female is a co-founder, but she has half what the other male co-founders have, right? And what this all started with is the ideal that we want to fuel women-led innovation. And it's important for us as investors to play our role and actually influence whose voice gets heard, right? What ideas get heard? And that, as you know, as an investor, matters when it comes to, you know, how much share of the company you own. So beyond just, you know, ticking a box of saying, okay, is that a female co-founder or founder? We would ask that funds go a little bit further to pay attention to the cap table and ask the hard questions, right? Who owns the patents of this technology? What does the share look like? You know, what are the voting requirements? What does that look like? You know, what sort of influence does the woman have within this company? And beyond that, I would also go into the practices of the portfolio companies, right? So we talk about ESG as a metrics. I think that's a great framework. You know, the IFC and many others have come up with multiple frameworks that people can look at. But we've seen some of our funds actually apply that to their own portfolio companies to ask the hard questions. You know, how many, what's the percentage of women in leadership? What does this look like? Is she influencing sales, or are you only having her in positions of, as we've seen a lot, just, you know, support positions, right? HR, people and culture, of course, they're important, but we want women as well that are driving the businesses, that are the engineers, that are, you know, heading up the innovation, right? So asking these sort of questions beyond that at a fund level, I would say for founders looking at a fund, look at the number of female partners within the fund, not just associates, not just analysts, but partners that actually have carry opportunity. And I do want to stress this because, you know, one of the key issues that we're seeing here, Catherine, is the fact that women have not had the opportunity to build their wealth. Maybe they've worked at the firm for a while, but they were not the name GP, right? So they didn't have the 20% carry that that fund connotes. And therefore, when they're spinning out of their own, they have limited capital, because remember, there's also the GP commit for many funds, right? Before you start a fund, you have to put in some amount of capital that's your own to show your conviction. And if women never had that opportunity to build that wealth, this is why we have the problem that we have, which is, you know, very little female fund managers. The number's growing, but it's still not the majority, right? And beyond that, I'll also look at policies within the fund. How are the partners, the managing partners, advocating for women, right? So it's not enough to say, okay, yeah, you know, our fund has 50% women, but all of them are working like hell and don't have, you know, the opportunity to think about family. And again, you know, when we talk about family, we often think about that with the woman, but it should also apply equally across the firm, right? Paternity leave, are the men allowed to take paternity leave? And what are the implications for that? And actually within our industry, Alexis Ohanian, you know, who's married to the wonderful Serena Williams, is a great advocate for this, right? He actually, I think, left his firm to open up space for others. He talks about how he even took leave as a partner to go and be with his wife and his child. And, you know, the fact that a paternity leave exists is not enough, is what I'm saying. It's whether men themselves are penalized, right, by taking this opportunity that exists, and whether that creates an unequal playing field, right? Because for the woman, she definitely has to go on maternity leave. She has to birth a baby. What does this mean in evaluating her performance and how she progresses? So, you know, having a fund that's thinking about these things, and you know, an LP, I've seen a couple of our LPs actually have these sort of heart-to-heart conversations with decision makers at funds. And I think this is a positive thing. So a couple of thoughts there.
Cool. Yeah. So I think both of quantity and quality should be included.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Actually, a common argument that we hear from within the industry, which is also like you mentioned before, is that there are not enough female founders to back, and also like not many female professionals are applying for the openings in venture capital or other financial institutions. Do you think that's a valid argument?
You know, this is a hard one for me to often answer, because the answer is complex, right? But for me, my first instinct is the answer is no, it's not a valid argument. There's, because of what we've seen, but I realize we have in some way the sample size that I have is already sort of positively selected, right? So the people that I would be interacting with would be the ones that would be already thinking about investing in women founders, that already have figured out a way and know that this is important. So for people like Palm Drive, right, what we've heard is there's not actually a pipeline problem when it comes to seeking female founder deal flow. But what we've heard from all funds that we like to label, you know, that over-index in female founders, is that, you know, you need to re-engineer your process, right? You need to meet women where they are. And of course, in certain pockets, you know, we have a fund that is super, super niche, right? There's doing sort of Series B, C, late stage B2B SaaS specifically for automotive companies only. That I accept may present some challenges, but again, you know, we need to start with this narrative that women are in different spaces and we need to go out there, find them and feel them. And we're actually seeing the results with that, right? So I think it's an easy cop-out, right? The issue is not that they don't exist, but is that we need to actually think about what does it take for us to get more women into the deal flow. And a way I actually might best explain this is through a real example that Shelly and I experienced actually during our process of campaigning for capital with one of, I wouldn't name names, but it was a large VC fund in Europe. And this partner told us, you know, Sarah and Shelly, when a woman comes through a door, through our door, we evaluate everyone absolutely equally. And then we pause and look at him, because obviously, you know, what's going on in Shelly in my head is we've looked at his portfolio and there was not a single female founder in the portfolio. It's a large fund. And of course, the problem presents itself. The question was the wrong one to ask. The question was not what you do when you evaluate everyone when, you know, at the point of evaluation, but the question is, what does it take for a woman to first come to and through your door? Right. So not just when she's at the door, you can't expect the woman to show up, but what does it take for a woman to come through that door? And as you know, being on the ground with sourcing deal flow, it's the networks that you're tapped into. Right. So do you even have a female associate, a female partner who most likely would come from certain networks that, you know, others don't, that will open up different possibilities? And I think that really is part of the solution. Another solution actually that we've seen one of our partners take on quite an innovative way, and this fund specifically focuses on science-based innovation, so biotech, bio-based technologies, things like that. And what this person has done, this fund has done, is to actually take on a venture studio model where they go deep into the universities to find researchers, patented technologies that they can commercialize and scale. And I was told almost half their candidates are actually women. So what they're doing now is they're offering funding and they're sort of becoming a co-founder to build from the ground up. And with, you know, initiatives like this, I think we're going to see a lot more women, even in the very, very niche spaces, and it'll only be a matter of time. And to your question on female professionals, you know, actually, this is untrue. The fact that there are few female professionals applying for openings in financial institutions, you know, my background in LeanIn. So LeanIn org, the US entity, actually does an annual report with McKinsey every year. And last year, they found that for women in finance at the entry level is actually 52%. That's pretty high, actually, yeah. From an industry perspective. But again, you wouldn't be surprised that the representation falls off at every step, you know, as you go into senior manager, C-suite, and this slide is particularly steep for women of color, right? Women who are Black, Latina, Asian, and that's unfortunate. But from entry level to the C-suite, the representation of women of color falls by 80%. And we can, you know, this is a different segue, but Palm Drive and Beyond the Billion were also part of AIM. I'm a proud, you know, member of the Asian American Investment Managers Association. And they did a report, as you may know, called the bamboo ceiling, right? Where Asian Americans, for example, are viewed to be good workers, but not good leaders. And I think that explains some of that. And you know, that's unfortunate. So, you know, I think the answer to your first question is no and no. But of course, as I had, you know, expanded, there are different nuances here that we have to think about, and still a journey for us to address, and why Beyond the Villains still exists, I guess.
Yeah, I think your examples and the cases also will also inspire the investors to do better in terms of the gender diversity on both GP and LP level. I think, lastly, I think we all wonder what's next for Beyond the Billion, and how can the industry leaders be part of this all?
The last couple of years in the trenches has taught us a lot, not just about the reality of the gender venture investment gap, but really how complex it is. And more importantly, the fact that there exists great potential where, you know, we can all be of great value to our stakeholders, right? So that the role that Beyond the Billion can play and continues to play. Female founders are innovating in ways that address a lot of the pressing problems that really inspire me personally, inspire Shelly, and really gets us up working every day. And we believe that part of the answer is also, you know, the funds who we know, funds like PalmDrive, who will continue to spot the untapped potential, right? The belief, you know, is exactly the title of this podcast, that innovators exist everywhere, and it is our job as investors to find them and to fuel them. And for us at Beyond the Villain, we're committed, you know, we're still committed to delivering on this mission to fuel women-led innovation. I think that was the core of why we began. And, you know, the second part, which was where Beyond the Villain came in, is the funds that invest in that. So stay tuned, I would say. You know, we've done a lot in the last couple of years. Don't think we're fully ready yet to announce what's next, but we'll be working with PalmDrive very closely. And of course, you know, we announced an initiative called Deca Berlin, which was celebrated at the MasterCard Inclusive Growth Summit by President Clinton. And that states a goal of unlocking more than $10 billion towards that very mission. So that's a very, very high goal. And hopefully, you know, I think with everything, the infrastructure that we've built, the fact that we work with over 100 venture funds across the globe and have access, you know, unparalleled access to great female founders across the stages, I think it'll be an exciting next chapter, and we're working hard towards it. And we look forward to continuing to be a force of diversity and returns and building the future together.
Well, great. I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you so much for your time, Sarah. And it's definitely a pleasure to work with you and Beyond the Billion. And also like Happy International Women's Day.
Happy International Women's Day. And it should be Women's Day every day, right? Yeah. So, you know, grateful for everything. You know, I want to take this opportunity to thank your partners, including Seaman Chan, who is one of the first few pledgees with us, who really, frankly, took a chance on me, right? when we proposed this idea. And, you know, he was quick to say this was the right thing to do, and it's a smart thing to do. And I know you all are really reaping the returns. So really proud of that and grateful for your partnership.
Thank you for listening to Innovators Are Everywhere. If you want to learn more, visit www.palmdrive.vc. Follow us on LinkedIn and hit the subscribe button.